Mr. Gorowski.
May it please the court, the Attorney General entered this case to urge the court to avoid any bright line rules other than those that this court has already ordained in AGD and Vincenti. The use of bright line rules is counterproductive and doesn't do service to the totality of circumstances test, which is fully designed and fully capable of determining when defendant's will is overborne and when proper waivers are had. So when the appellate division invoked State versus Sims, and I referencing the question from my colleague, is the appellate division seemed to rely on it as if they were bound by it. They said, we need not decide whether the detective properly addressed the question of waiver because we are satisfied that the failure to tell them of the charges. So they seemed bound by that case. And they didn't bother to cite that certification was granted. This was the type of case that was clear that certification would be sought. So we asked this court to perhaps make a requirement that when this court stays a ruling, in fact, that's why the state usually asks for this stay, is so that we're not bound by the ruling and we want time to litigate it. So we would ask the court to say that unless the court is relying on it for persuasive authority, then they should not invoke cases that have been granted by the court and a stay has been granted as if it was just a regular decision of the court. Also, stated that the Attorney General is concerned about things that aren't labeled bright line rules but have the same effect as bright line rules. Sometimes when parties say, well, we recognize the totality of circumstances test, we just think when this happens, that's really dispositive and it really permeates the entire encounter. We urge the court not to apply any type of test that would have that effect. Just by way of example, not that we're discussing the overall merits of the totality of circumstances here, but a question such as, you're not in trouble, that would be best determined under the totality of circumstances test. It should not be part of a bright line rule that every time the police say that, it should necessarily require reversal. Nor should there be a rule that whenever the police say that, it carries such weight that it overwhelms the totality of circumstances and requires reversal.
Mr. Morosky, isn't that a two-edged sword? I think Mr. Gualdieri said to us before the break that it was good to have a bright line rule in Sims about what the police are permitted to do or don't have to do. And that can be useful in, of course, you know, training new officers on the law. So are you arguing that you only want us to avoid bright line rules that work in favor of the government?
Your Honor, no, Sims was not a bright line rule. In fact, this court's opinion in Sims rejected the bright line rule that the police have to tell them on pain of reversal. Instead, this court said that we look to the officer's absence of that information under the totality of circumstances. So no, Sims was not a bright line rule.
Yeah, but there are bright line rules sometimes that the court has adopted that are actually favorable to the interests of law enforcement, right?
Well, a bright line rule, it says that whenever the police don't tell them about pending arrests, that the statement gets suppressed, an otherwise voluntary statement gets suppressed, and a potential murder conviction gets reversed. That's not beneficial to law enforcement, Your Honor. That's a cure that's worse than the disease. We would ask for no draconian bright line rules to that effect. But, you know, the totality of circumstances is big enough and robust enough to incorporate all of these things. That's the great thing about the totality of circumstances test is that nothing's automatically in, nothing's automatically out. You wait for what it's worth. But it should never get to the point where something in the totality of circumstances test is so important that it overwhelms the test, because that's just another way of creating a bright line rule. Other bright line rules. In fact, this case is farther removed from Sims. In Sims, the defendant was actually arrested. Here, it was a de facto arrest. I mean, when are the police supposed to know when they've committed a de facto arrest? They don't know that until a year later, when at the motion to suppress, the judge tells them, oh, by the way, that was a de facto arrest. That's not guidance at all. That sows more confusion. But I think even the defendant realizes that Sims' reversal renders that part of the appellate division's opinion ineffective.
Mr. Murawski, what about false statements by the police? Should they get more weight in the totality of the circumstances analysis?
I think it would depend on the totality of circumstances and what the false statement is. Like, what if the police make a general statement that, you know, hey, there was a lot of people there, and we're going to be talking to all those witnesses. We're going to be getting their statements, too. Do you have to now go back and make sure the police talk to all the witnesses there before you can verify that they didn't tell an untruth? No, the police are allowed to not, the bottom line is, will it overbear someone's will? If the police tell an untruth that overbears somebody's will, that's typically the standard under the totality of circumstances. That's typically the standard used. There could be some innocuous, quote untruths like I just mentioned, where the police could say, oh, we have videos, we're going to be looking at the videos. Maybe the videos don't show much, but the police are allowed to impress upon the suspect that they're going to conduct a fuller investigation.
And what if the false statement is not an innocuous one?
If it's not an innocuous one, then that would weigh heavier in the totality of circumstances, but it would not necessarily be dispositive. I mean, that's the great thing about the totality of circumstances is it depends on the circumstances, hence the definition, as to how much weight to give something. Certain untruths might carry a lot more consequences and might go towards overbearing someone's will, and other untruths just might be innocuous things that are just said in passing. So this court should avoid a rule that just says any untruth will jeopardize a waiver. It would depend on the magnitude, and that's where the totality of circumstances does its good work. Also, wanted to just address general principles as to the custody issue. We all know that it's not free to leave. Free to leave is part of the equation, but that's not the end-all and be-all of custody. Because if you say not free to leave is Miranda custody, then the police could never conduct a Terry stop. They could never conduct a car stop. They could never conduct an investigative detention without prefacing their questions with Miranda warnings. And we all know that that's unnecessary and counterproductive. Of course, it's a big factor in the totality of circumstances, but it's not singularly dispositive. You don't just say, and it's also more important into what's going through the suspect's mind and not going through what the officer says. The officer saying, oh yeah, I wasn't going to let him go, that's not necessarily dispositive as to the custodial inquiry. It's what would a person in the suspect's shoes believe, a reasonable person in the suspect's shoes believe. So with that, the Attorney General asked this court to eschew any bright line rules in rendering this decision and to elevate any individual factor to the extent of overriding, in a sense, bright line rule.
Thank you.
You're taking no position on the specific merits of this case.
We do not.
Thank you, Mr. McNamara.
May it please the court. I'd like to thank the court on behalf of the County Prosecutors Association in New Jersey for the opportunity to address these issues. Similar to the Attorney General, our original institutional interest was the extension of Sims to the facts of this case. So that's one of the reasons that we sought to amicus, and based on this court's opinion in Sims, clearly the rationale that the appellate division relied upon is no longer sustainable, and therefore we did request and we agree that a remand should be appropriate. However, since the issues and the tone and timbre of the court's questions, if I may address some of the issues that the court rose, because obviously we do have an institutional interest on how the totality of circumstance test might be rendered going forward in a post-Sims world, as well as asking the court to take this opportunity to sort of clearly delineate some of the looseness in language and some of the looseness in some of the intellectual approaches to these issues. There are some fundamental principles that apply, and I think it's important that this court provide guidance to the trial courts and practitioners as to what the actual analytic font of power that you're drawing from when we're talking about the totality of circumstances test. First and foremost, there are two separate totality of circumstance tests. One is the due process voluntariness test, and then there's the totality of circumstance test is whether or not a waiver was valid if a defendant was subject to custodial interrogation. And like the Attorney General, we advocate that not every circumstance would be relevant to those ultimate legal determinations, and the weight they give or are given, really would depend upon what aspect of the analysis that one is undertaking. There are some concrete principles, and those concrete principles, I believe, provide a structure and guidance for a court to then work within the totality of circumstance framework. The concrete principles, clearly from this court's jurisprudence, is first, an invocation is not self-executing, so that any invocation requires something on behalf of the subject to assert it. In New Jersey, since this court has indicated a reluctance to adopt the federal standard of a clear assertion of a right, there's clearly the concrete principle that the state and law enforcement has a duty to clarify ambiguous invocations.
Is that raised by this case?
It is in this sense, because I think when you're talking about things of status and talking about am I in trouble or you're in trouble or best practices or looking at some of the arguments put forward by the defendant, that's where I think there is this sort of leakage between certain concepts and certain arguments of advocacy. The ambiguity would require the police in some circumstance, if someone said to the law enforcement, am I in trouble? That would then, under the duty to clarify, may require some sort of affirmative conversation by the law enforcement. But that is different than creating an obligation for the police to say you are in trouble, or that being some sort of factor, the fact that they do not say that, going into that bucket of circumstances.
There's no ambiguous invocation argument being made in this case, is there?
No, but I think that's what I'm saying. I think one of the issues, if we're talking about status or am I in trouble, some of the doctrinal underpinnings of that, those cases, or some of the doctrinal underpinnings of that rationale really goes into the concept of whether or not you're talking about a ambiguous invocation, requiring the police to have some sort of input, some sort of conversation, because ultimately the police have to provide information sufficient so that the suspect understands the ramifications of a waiver and the consequence that those words may be used in court. Ultimately, the County Prosecutors Association is requesting the court to make clear that in the totality of circumstance analysis, no one particular circumstance would ever be dispositive. It may be entitled to greater weight. Addressing one of the questions regarding the statement, are you in trouble, or you're not in trouble, excuse me. I committed my own sin of loose language. You're not in trouble certainly would fall within this court's jurisprudence that law enforcement should not say things that dilute the meaning or the scope of the Miranda warnings. But in this particular case, I think the immediate thickening agent to that dilution was the immediate administration of the Miranda warnings as the state has advocated. I think in the totality of circumstance analysis, that circumstance may not give as much heft to that particular statement. Following up on the chief's question, certainly it would not be something that we would be training or requesting law enforcement officers to do. We recognize this court's jurisprudence, and we welcome the jurisprudence, that dilution of the rights themselves, of that particular idea, is separate, though, from the idea of an adversarial system that, in theory, accepts the premise, and not necessarily in theory, but as part of this court's longstanding precedent and jurisprudence, that admissions by defendants and confessions by defendants are not inherently evil or bad in a system of justice. The steps to minimize compulsion, I believe, is the through line that this court can follow when it's adapting a totality of circumstance analysis in this case, as well as providing guidance to the lower courts. It's simply a different analysis. It would be a different weighing. If the defendant asked, am I in trouble, as opposed to being told you're not in trouble, as opposed to the police officers not saying anything, because clearly under Nyhammer and Vincente, the police would not have violated any of this court's longstanding precedent, as made clear in AGD and Sims, if they said nothing regarding de facto arrest or whether or not you were free to go or not. Certainly relevant to the custodial interrogation prong of Miranda, which then would flip back to that idea that waiver has to be viewed under a totality of circumstance, and while no one single statement would be given weight. If I may, there was a question regarding false statements, and I know it's not necessarily four square in this case. I know the Middlesex County Prosecutor's Office indicated that their position is that trouble was not a false statement, was not an incorrect statement. I just prefer to take, and I'd ask this court to take a universal view so I can give an example of a totality of circumstance where a false statement may not necessarily automatically render a statement involuntary. I'd ask the court to imagine a situation of a one-witness homicide captured on video, where it's clear there's only one witness. It's the person who commits the murders captured on video. I can certainly see a circumstance where that subject, that target, is not going to be informed that in that robbery, that person is dead, because that is going to give the suspect information that, wow, great, the only witness who could identify me is dead. I think that's where the looseness gets involved. I think there's a false premise that the idea that voluntariness should be pegged to the idea of lawyers and judges and practitioners, that if you knew all of this information, you would exercise your right. That goes to the wisdom of whether or not someone invokes their rights. That's not what our legal system foresees, going back as far as McKnight. The phrase of this court, the Constitution is not offended if a guilty offender stubs his toe. So the idea of false statements certainly goes into the calculus. I stood before this court, along with Mr. Murawski, when we argued Sims within this well. And clearly, we have not changed our position. The County Prosecutors Association has not changed its position that it is a circumstance to be considered. But we do ask this court to make sure that it's clear in whatever opinion you render in this case, that because it's in this case and you might find this case to be an invalid waiver, that doesn't necessarily mean every single time, every single instance, every single circumstance might warrant that. Finally, I think that just the citation to Rule 136.3 would have solved the issue regarding the statement being, with the opinion being stayed. Certainly, the persuasive reasoning of any court can be done, but I think this court has a framework within your own court rules already, how they've been promulgated as to how to handle that situation. The concern that Mr. Murawski and the Attorney General puts forth, clearly the County Prosecutor's Association has an acute interest in when a published appellate decision is published, we seek a stay to avoid trial courts from saying, I'm bound by this published opinion, and then creating many more cases in the pipeline for any prospective retroactive application. So I just think that's really more of a administrative issue that the court can just simply handle with a cite to the court rule.
With the help of the parties.
Certainly with the help of the parties. Certainly with the help of the parties. Court has no other questions. Thank you again on behalf of the County Prosecutor's Association.
Thank you, Ms. Watson.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I had originally requested a 5-minute opening. I'd like to waive that today. This court has consistently restated that the essential purpose of Miranda is to empower a person in police custody with knowledge of his basic constitutional rights so that he can exercise, according to his free will, the right against self-incrimination or waive that right and answer questions. In this case, the Miranda warnings did not serve their intended purpose because over the course of a 12-hour interrogation, certain police tactics destroyed the curative effect of the warnings and the police failed to obtain a valid waiver of Mr. Bullock's Miranda rights. The trial court, after reviewing the interrogation video, and the testimony of two of the interrogating detectives found that the state had not met its burden of proving a valid waiver beyond a reasonable doubt. That decision should be affirmed. My argument today will focus on the validity of the first two waivers, the first on the college campus and the second approximately 4 hours later at the police station. And I'd just like to clarify some of the facts briefly. Mr. Bullock was encountered in the dorm hallway. The police officer told him that he was conducting an investigation and asked for his driver's license. At that point, the officer testified that he wasn't free to leave. And I understand that we don't, in determining custody, the police officer's subjective intent doesn't rule, but I think that's an important factor in this case. The police officer told him something was said and that he had to speak to a number of parties who heard it. At one point, Mr. Bullock asked to go outside and he was told, wait for them to come over and we'll take you somewhere else. So at a minimum, at that point, that was custody. And in the hallway, the police officer said, why are we here tonight? And defendant said, because I made a statement. And he said, what statement did you make? Like, I want to harm someone. So this all occurred before any Miranda warnings were given. So once they move outside into the courtyard, the police officer testified that at this point I gave Miranda warnings because I assessed that the line of questioning might go towards some incriminating responses. And so he told defendant, look, before any of this goes anywhere else right now, you're not under arrest, you are not in trouble, I'm going to advise you of your Miranda rights. This occurs in the span of about 20 seconds. The detective recited the warnings. He asked Mr. Bullock if he understood, and now there's some question as to whether there was a nod, and then no more than 2 or 3 seconds later, he launched into the interrogation.
Sorry, can I just follow up with one question? So when Mr. Bullock was asked why the officers were there and responded because he made a statement, you're saying that was in the hallway and not in the courtyard?
That was in the dorm hallway, yes.
So as soon as they got out to the courtyard, that's when the Miranda warnings were immediately given?
There's a very brief conversation in the courtyard where he says, look, we're a little bit above that right now. This has gone above my head, way above your head. There are people that are much bigger than us involved in this right now. And defendant was told, we just got to get through this. We're going to ask you a bunch of questions. And then the police officer says, look, before this goes any further, you're not in trouble, you're not under arrest, and gives the Miranda warnings.
Watson, may I pause you there chronologically? What basis would there be for the court to exclude the incriminating statements your client made before the assurances were made about you're not under arrest, you're not in trouble? What would be the basis to exclude those statements?
My position today proceeds from the premise that the custodial interrogation was at the latest point when they were in the courtyard. So I'm going to focus on the first waiver. I know that Amiki had pinned custody earlier, and I think there's a very strong argument that perhaps there was a custodial interrogation in the dorm hallway. But my position, because the state has conceded that at a minimum, at the latest point, custody was in the courtyard.
So would the earlier statements then be admissible?
I think there's a very strong argument that it's not, but I recognize that it's one statement. Why are we here tonight? Because I made a statement. And what statement did you make? Like, I want to harm someone. So I think the heart of the matter is the validity of the first waiver. So I'm just going to focus on that.
All right. Thank you.
So I am not asking that this case be analyzed under anything but the totality of the circumstances test. But obviously the weight of the particular circumstances will depend on the circumstances of the case. And I think as it relates to the first waiver, there are four factors that I would like to focus on. The you're not in trouble, you're not under arrest statement, the Mr. Bullock's lack of criminal experience, the rushed and hurried delivery of the warning, and the fact that there was no actual inquiry into whether he wanted to waive. I recognize that Mr. Bullock was not technically under arrest at the point that the officer made that statement, but that was still a misleading statement because the police officer was conducting an investigation and he knew that the questioning may lead to incriminating responses, and he gave him Miranda warnings because of that. So while he may not have been under arrest yet, That was misleading, and there was no caveat that this was like a temporary situation. You're not under arrest right now. No one said that. It's just you're not under arrest. The other part of that statement was false, that he's not in trouble. He was a suspect in a criminal case. Everyone's understanding of trouble is pretty broad. It generally means that there are not going to be any negative consequences to your conduct. And it's generally something that people in a position of authority tell to a teacher, tells a child, a parent tells children. Like, look, just tell me the truth. You're not in trouble. That's everyone's general understanding of it. And I think the timing of this statement is critical. This was the preface to the Miranda warnings. It sort of blunted their impact. You know, in Nyhammer, this court said that the Miranda warnings are supposed to scream out that you're a suspect. The United States Supreme Court in Miranda said that the warnings are supposed to signal to you that you're faced with a phase of the adversary system and that you're not in the presence of persons solely acting in your interest. The Miranda warnings are supposed to put you on alert. But at the outset of that, when you tell someone, look, you're not in trouble, you're not in arrest, the warnings don't serve that purpose. And defendant did not ask about his predicament. This was information that was just volunteered to him alongside these critical warnings that he likely tuned out because you're not in trouble, you're not under arrest, suggests that what follows is really not that important. And it's really difficult to reconcile warnings with that statement about you not being in trouble and not under arrest.
I'm sorry, just one more point of clarification. So when your client is in the courtyard and he is surrounded by three officers, at that point, he is not asked why the officers are there. And that's not when he responds because he made a statement about wanting to harm his girlfriend and her family. Instead, that had all already happened before
that happened,
they got to the courtyard.
That happened in the hallway, and then he's taken outside with the other two officers, and then the conversation continues about we're going to ask you a bunch of questions, and then the Miranda warnings are given.
You're not under arrest is very different from you're not in trouble. Would you agree with me?
I think they're not equally problematic. I think you're not under arrest is technically accurate at that point, but it's incomplete information because you're not under arrest, but we're doing an investigation that may lead to your arrest.
Where in our jurisprudence do you find a requirement to say we are now conducting an investigation that would lead to your arrest? That's another way of saying Nyhammer, isn't it?
Our jurisprudence does not require police officers to tell someone that they're a suspect or to tell them anything about their predicament unless charges have been filed.
Right.
So I'm not saying that the police officers had an affirmative duty to offer this information. I'm saying that they should not have volunteered any information that minimized the seriousness of his predicament. Because this is, had they not said anything at all, they could have simply just said, here are the Miranda warnings. This preface wasn't necessary. They have no affirmative obligation to tell him anything about his suspect status. But the corollary to that is that they shouldn't make any misrepresentations about his status.
But in terms of you're not under arrest, they have an obligation to say you are under arrest, if he is.
The case law has not said that once someone is placed under arrest, you have an obligation to say you're under arrest as a condition.
If he asks, am I under arrest, he should be told that? Is that?
If he asks if he's under arrest, the police officer should give him accurate information. And that would be that, you know, if the person is in fact under arrest, then they should say so.
So are you looking for a ruling by this court that an officer should not volunteer you're not under arrest?
I think that's a better practice. I don't think that the mere fact of volunteering that information in every case will result in a suppression of a statement. But this is not, you know, Nyhammer.
It's accurate.
I'm sorry?
If it's an accurate statement, why is it problematic?
If it's an accurate statement, it's not problematic. It's an inaccurate statement here that is it's incomplete, but it's not just that you're not under arrest, it's the other part of that. It's the
Understand.
Two things together.
Yeah, that's why I was trying to take those two statements apart, and I thought you were kind of grouping them together as problematic statements.
I think the best practices is if a police officer is conducting an interrogation and he's given Miranda warnings because he thinks there may be incriminating statements that could lead to the person's arrest, saying at the outset you're not under arrest is disarming. And slightly inaccurate. It's sort of providing this false assurance that dulls what is to come, which is like what you say can and will be used against you. The other circumstances of this, Mr. Bullock had no prior criminal experience, and that is something that the trial judge placed a lot of weight on. He didn't understand the purpose of a custodial interrogation. He had no basis to assess this information that was given to him, having never been arrested or interrogated or seen the process unfold. And then there is the warnings were delivered over the span of 17 seconds orally. There was no time for him to deliberate on the meaning of the words or even the option that was being presented to him. I'm not suggesting that there is, Miranda warnings need to be issued in a particular matter. I'm saying in this case, where there are no written warnings, this is all unfolding quickly. And they were kind of spewed at him. And then he's asked, do you understand this? And this head nod, the trial judge did not make a factual finding on it. The police officer testified at one point that he did ask if he understood, and then another point he testified that he didn't ask if he understood. At that point, Mr. Bullock had his hands on his face. It's difficult to discern the actual physical response, but the validity of this waiver does not rise or fall on whether he nodded his head to his warnings being given to him in this manner, and then without any, and what is clear, though, is that no question was asked of him, do you understand these warnings? And then the last point, as it relates to the first waiver, there was no question, again, as to whether you're willing to waive. And I recognize that New Jersey follows the implicit waiver doctrine. In Tillery, this court said that the best practices was to have a form that guided police officers to ask whether the suspect understands his rights, and whether understanding those rights, he or she is willing to answer those questions. That question was never asked. So all we're relying on here is the fact that he responded to police interrogation as evidence of an implicit waiver. That doesn't prove that the waiver was voluntary, knowing, and intelligent. It's not as though this was someone with criminal experience who got his rights and then launched into his version of events. That would show that there was a waiver. And even in Burgess, where you had, that's by a preponderance of the evidence standard, there that defendant had the form. The police officer read the form to him. He read the form himself, and there was time to actually deliberate. So I think under these circumstances, you can't have a valid implicit waiver when Miranda warnings are issued this way with this statement at the outset that undermines the warnings.
Ms. Watson, a few times you've used the phrase best practice. So I'm a little confused about your position in terms of, are you arguing at all for any bright line rules here, or would it suffice for an opinion of this court to discourage, improper conduct by law enforcement to say the best practice is this or best practice is to not to do that? Would that suffice?
I'm not suggesting that the failure to follow the best practices with respect to each of these individual things should result in suppression. I mentioned that to say is like what happened here is far less than ideal. Like under the best circumstances, police officers shouldn't be issuing Miranda warnings in this manner. But given this person's lack of criminal experience and the misleading statement, that renders this invalid.
Under the totality of
the totality of the circumstances. But I'm not suggesting that, the mere fact that the warnings was read over the course of 17 seconds means that, that's invalid. I'm just saying the combination of everything.
Thank you.
If there are no questions on the first waiver, I'd like to move on to the second. So when Mr. Bullock was asked to waive his rights at the police station, he did so having already incriminated himself after the invalid waiver on the college campus. That was a relatively short period of custodial interrogation, but nonetheless, what came out of that was a sweeping admission of what he had done, which was discussing wanting to have killed his ex-girlfriend's parents. He provided a motive to the police officers for that thought, and he also provided police officers with background information. The cat was out of the bag. And so 4 hours after this, he's brought to the police station and he sits there for 4 hours. And then the police officer enters and says, so since you're here, I have to read you your rights. I know you spoke to officers prior, but we just have to do it again. The police officer read each right and asked the defendant to acknowledge that he understood, and then instructed defendant to read aloud the waiver portion and sign and date it. Now, the trial judge found that this waiver was also invalid. And in addressing the Sims issue, that portion of the appellate division's decision in Bullock has been abrogated. The court relied on a per se rule that no longer exists, so I'm not, that part of the decision just doesn't stand. I do not think that this case needs to be remanded to the appellate division for them to apply the right test. The trial judge did not apply Sims in suppressing the statement, so the factual record is developed. This court...
There were issues that were not reached by the appellate division because it was applying the appellate division decision in Sims. Am I correct about that?
The appellate division didn't review the trial judge's application of Tillery to the second interrogation because it relied on Sims.
We simply have its determination on Sims. That's it.
Yes, but that's a legal determination that the appellate, like this court doesn't owe any deference to the appellate division for their legal determination. And oftentimes the court is confronted with cases in which the appellate division applies the wrong standard. And the court doesn't just announce the new standard. The court announces that standard and applies the facts when the facts aren't in dispute.
And the fact that the judge made no factual findings about the head nod, you say doesn't matter and shouldn't go back to the trial court.
Well, I don't think the head nod establishes waiver beyond reasonable doubt. If this court believes that the head nod is a critical factor, then I wouldn't object. But I think this record is pretty well developed without a finding on the head nod. The head nod is just, do you understand these things that have been told to you over the course of 17 seconds, and then interrogation.
Are you objecting to the Miranda form that was used by Detective Trito at the station?
Just Sabatino, again, I think that this form is unideal.
So what's the specific problem with the form?
The specific problem with the form is that it tells the defendant at the outset, it says, you have these rights. There is no question about whether you are willing to waive those rights. What happens next is it says, the police officer told him, read this section, which is the waiver of Miranda, and sign it. So the form, the way that it's constructed, puts the onus on the defendant to stop and speak up and object. It doesn't invite an inquiry into waiver at all. It doesn't ask, having understood these rights, are you willing to waive them? It says, you're going to read this thing, and then you have to recognize what you're reading, essentially. And if you don't want to waive your rights, then the defendant is in the position of having to stop everything and say, hey, this is not actually what I'm agreeing to.
Is the end of the form have language about express waiver?
Right, doesn't it say, I have been advised of my rights and I understand what my rights are. I will voluntarily speak with you and answer questions.
Yes, and the way that this unfolds, though, is that he's told, the police officer read the individual rights, and she says, do you understand these individual rights, and put your initial on there. And then he's told, there's no question, are you willing to then waive those rights? He's just told to read this section and sign. Without a question as to waiver.
Doesn't the written form say, I have been advised of my rights and I understand what my rights are? So what specifically are you saying that, the officers always have to go beyond the form in a specific way? Or are you saying the form itself is constitutionally defective and the form needs to be changed? Is it that the form can never be enough and the officers always have to go beyond it in a specific way?
I think given the circumstances of this interrogation, this form suggested to the defendant that he didn't have a choice. So at the outset of the second interrogation, He's told, so since you're here, I have to read you your rights again, and I know you spoke to officers prior, but we just have to do it again. The trial judge made a factual finding that the way that this form was presented to defendant was as though it was just an administrative measure that he needed to complete again because he was now at the police station. And I think this form is consistent with that idea. This form is not saying, are you willing to waive your rights? This form presupposes that he's made a decision about waiver and that he has to sign it. It didn't, I think it's interesting when you
sign it, it does have it specifically set off waiver of Miranda rights. And then it says, I have been advised of my rights and I understand what my rights are. I will voluntarily speak with you and answer questions. Doesn't that indicate to someone that they should not sign it if they don't agree with that statement?
Well, the defendant has to infer that from the form. What I was suggesting
is
that
a very typical form that's used.
I'm not that familiar. I think that this form may, I know that after Tillery, this court suggested that the Attorney General should devise a form that directs the police officers to engage in two inquiry, one about whether the person understands their right and the other about whether they're willing to waive their right. This form doesn't direct any inquiry of that sort. It doesn't hint at a choice at all. It presumes that the person has made a choice and they're reading this, and then they have to stop if that's not their choice. And I think it's interesting when you compare it to the upper half of the form and how that was, how that proceeded. That section, he was asked, do you understand these things, but then never asked, are you willing to waive? But I think that because at the outset of this interrogation involves him being told that we're just doing it again because you're at the police station, that's the problem. He's not signed a form before, and it suggests that this is just formalizing a decision that he's already made.
Right, because that's your main argument, that the cat is out of the bag at the point where he's sitting down, signing this form, whatever it says on the form. Your main argument is the cat was already out of the bag. The officers at the outset say, we're doing this again. You already spoke to officers. So it's a continuation of the previous statements that he already made at the campus on near the dorm, and he had not at that point been told, by the way, the statements that you made prior to being Mirandized are not going to be used against you or cannot be used against you.
Correct. Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
What is the cat is out of the bag theory? It's that once someone has already made incriminating statements, then even if they're warned 5 hours later, 12 hours later, 24 hours later with separate officers in a totally separate setting, that it can just basically never be undone because the cat is out of the bag?
Well, we don't have a bright line rule. It's not that it can never be undone. The idea is that once you've incriminated yourself without being properly warned or a proper waiver, when you later on get your Miranda warnings, like those warnings can't function effectively in giving you the choice of remaining silent. You will think that it's futile to remain silent because you've already told the police the thing that's damning. And so it's not, unless there are these additional steps taken or under certain circumstances, a defendant is not going to truly believe at that point that he has a choice to invoke his Miranda warnings. Unless would the court like me to go through the additional O'Neill factors as it relates to the second interrogation?
Not necessary, unless there's something you want to stress.
One second. I just want to stress the trial judge's factual findings on this. On page 44, the trial judge, again, following this cat out of the bag, said that the references to the prior conversation with Archibald, both at the start of the Miranda inquiry and after the form was complete, presented itself as a gateway into further discussion. These were not two distinct interrogation experiences for a defendant. He said something to the police officer on the campus. The new interrogating officer told him, we're aware of what you said. They took a statement and we're just doing this. We're doing this Miranda thing again because you're now here. Under those circumstances, this waiver was not voluntary, knowing and intelligent beyond a reasonable doubt. Unless the court has any additional questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Bialik.
afternoon, Chief Justice, Your Honors, may it please the court. On behalf of ACDL, I thank the court for the opportunity to be here and to present my argument. We would urge the court to find today that law enforcement cannot tell an interrogee that they are not a suspect, not a target, or otherwise mislead a person into misunderstanding the seriousness of the charges they could be facing. And I'm going to go out on a limb here and request that the court consider adopting a per se rule to that effect. And I'd like to explain this in two steps, similar to the way that this court explained the issue in State versus Pillar. The first has to do with the adequacy of the Miranda warnings themselves. That is, was Miranda properly administered? And the second issue is whether Miranda can be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary in terms of a waiver when law enforcement mislead a suspect into misunderstanding his, quote, true status within the criminal justice system. On the adequacy of the Miranda warnings, the jurisprudence developed by this court makes clear that law enforcement cannot make any statements that have the effect of minimizing, undercutting, or neutralizing the warnings, diminishing their significance, or relegating them to mere formalities. This principle was illustrated in Pillar, where officer elicited a waiver after telling defendant that he can speak off the record. Another example is this court's decision in State versus ODAC, where officers told the defendant that anything he said would remain confidential. Or in State versus Interest of AS, where officers told the juvenile that the statements he made could only help him and not hurt him. This court has held that such statements totally undermine and eviscerate the purpose of the Miranda warnings. Misleading statements and promises by the police, quote, choke off the legal process at the very moment that Miranda was designed to protect. Statements suggesting the Miranda warnings are little more than a bureaucratic checklist to be checked off is wrong. And here, the Miranda warnings cannot be said to have been made adequately and correctly, because in the same sentence, the officers said things that totally eviscerate and undercut the warnings themselves. Telling Mr. Bullock that he was not in trouble and not under arrest neutralizes the warnings and what they were designed to protect. It's literally the same as telling somebody that they don't need a lawyer because they're not in trouble, or that anything they say can't be used against them and can only help them. It gives the false impression.
Do you really think those are on the same plane? You have a specific right to counsel. That saying to someone you don't need a lawyer is the same as the statement that was made here. I know you prefaced your argument by talking about saying you're not a target, you're not a suspect. But what happened here, we're talking about here?
Well, what happened here is Mr. Bullock was expressly told, you are not in trouble.
Understood. Do you really think that's on the same plane as saying, don't, whatever we just said, you don't need a lawyer?
Well, saying that you're not in trouble is indicating that anything you say can only be helpful and not be used against you. And the reason that I say that is because that was followed by numerous statements by the officers that all they were looking for were assurances. You're not in trouble, you're not under arrest, and this has gone above our heads, and our superiors are looking for assurances, assurances that you're not going to go out and harm somebody. And you can tell over the course of the next 12 hours, Mr. Bullock was attempting to do that which the officers told him that he should do, provide them with assurances. Little did he know he was going to be charged with attempted murder. And so by telling somebody that they're not in trouble, essentially, is the same as telling them that what you say can't be used against you. It can only help you. So in that respect, it reinforces a false impression that the person won't be criminally prosecuted. They simply let their guard down and speak to the officers. And especially for somebody like Mr. Bullock, who doesn't have any prior criminal experience, has had no run-in with the criminal justice system, it wouldn't signal to a layperson that things that they said, the assurances that they provide, could actually subject him to criminal prosecution.
Well, I'd like to ask you the same question I asked Ms. Watson. Why wouldn't it suffice for this court to say that the best practice would be to refrain from making such false assurances?
The court could say that, but the reason that I advocate for a per se standard is because I cannot envision any circumstances under which law enforcement can tell someone that they're not in trouble, that they're not a suspect, that they're not going to face criminal prosecution, elicit a waiver, and for that to be okay.
Well, Mr. Murawski suggested a hypothetical with, you know, the one witness situation where it, if you were honest with the defendant, you could put others in peril. I mean, it, wouldn't that kind of situation, or maybe others that we could imagine, not fit the rule?
I'm not sure I follow.
With other situations can be imagined where it would be tolerable within the, or at least not dispositive, within the totality of circumstances that an assurance was made for other, you know, legitimate law enforcement reasons.
Best practices and the totality of circumstances certainly is an option and likely what this court will go with, because we know that per se rules are applied in very limited circumstances. But, and this sort of bleeds into my second argument, there are certain limited instances where this court has dispensed with the totality of circumstances argument, where information that is critical to a person's knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver is not provided to them. And we see that in State versus Reed and in AGD and Vincenti. This court has held that there is certain information that is so indispensable that goes to the heart of the waiver process that without that information, a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver cannot be made. And the ACDL would respectfully submit that this falls within that exception. Now, following Nyhammer and most recently in Sims, you know, we know the law is clear that police have no affirmative obligation to inform a defendant of his suspect status or the potential of criminal charges. But this is different. This is misleading a defendant into believing that he's not a suspect and that no criminal charges are forthcoming. And it's tantamount to the same type of deception and the same withholding of essential information that renders a waiver ineffective. Misleading a suspect, even when done in good faith, about potential criminal liability at the very moment that the waiver is effectuated essentially eviscerates his ability to knowingly and intelligently waive his Miranda rights. The officer's telling Mr. Bullock that he's not in trouble mere seconds before Mirandizing him signaled to him that he need not worry. It removes the veil of suspicion. And he made statements that he otherwise might not have made if he even had a conscious thought in his head that the police officers were there to question him for the purpose of potentially bringing criminal charges. The statement simply signaled to Mr. Bullock that he need not fear criminal prosecution. And I don't want to get into the O'Neill factors, but there was a continuing failure to correct Mr. Bullock's misimpression by Officer Trito, because they relied on proper administration of Miranda the first time around. And I would respectfully refer this court to the Appellate Division's recent decision in Diaz, which we cited in our brief, that it's one thing for the police to withhold information, but it's quite another entirely for them to provide an explanation that creates or reinforces a false impression as to the seriousness of the sentence that the defendant is facing.
But this is not Diaz. This is a different situation. Diaz involved the distinction between a homicide prosecution and a potentially a drug sales or drug possession prosecution.
But the concept is the same. The defendant in Diaz was brought in on what he believed to be charges of possession with intent to distribute, maybe 3 to 5 years, and he elected, based on his misimpression that that's what he was being questioned about, to waive his Miranda, when in reality, he's looking at a drug-induced homicide 20 to 30 years. So it goes to the heart of the waiver, and it affects that decision. And in the similar respect here, it's one thing for Mr. Bullock to believe that he is being questioned as a suspect with the potential fear of criminal charges looming over him, and quite another to be told, don't worry, you're not in any trouble, you're not under arrest. And I should emphasize, in this case, he was told he's not under arrest, not that one time in the courtyard, but he proceeded to be told 7 or 8 times over the course of his car ride from the courtyard to the police station. So he was told he's not in trouble. 7 or 8 different times he's told he's not under arrest, and at least 6 times he's told our superiors are just looking for assurances. So in Mr. Bullock's mind, who has, again, no run-in with the criminal justice system, he made statements, he was frustrated, he saw a psychiatrist, he was not going to go through with anything. As a layperson, it would not have occurred to him that statements that he had made could subject him to criminal liability. And here were officers on scene telling him, don't worry, you're not in trouble. We just want assurances that nobody's going to get hurt. So all of those things play into that waiver decision that could not have been knowing and voluntary.
Well, I think we have your position. Is there anything you'd like to add in drawing it to a close?
I know my time's up. So the one thing that I would just say is beyond a reasonable doubt is an extraordinarily high burden. And this court specifically elected to depart from the federal standard and impose a more rigorous burden on the state to prove a knowing and intelligent waiver beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would respectfully submit that that standard cannot be met with what could or could not be a head nod and the ability of a defendant to simply read the warnings. There has to be more. And I believe the trial judge said it correctly here, that in order to meet the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, there has to be a two-part inquiry. And that has to be, does the defendant understand his rights, and is he willing to waive them? And that is the part that has to be shown beyond a reasonable doubt.
Thank you, Kim.
I appreciate this court's time.
Francois.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. Your Honors, this case is a poster child example of what happens when somebody's Miranda rights are treated as a mere formality. The consequences, as we see in Mr. Bullock's case, are devastating, and they come like a runaway train that cannot be stopped. I want to revisit some of the discussion that occurred today because I do think it's significant. One of the main threads in this case, and something that has to be reemphasized over and over again, is the fact that Mr. Bullock has no prior contacts with the criminal justice system. And I think that's an analysis that the state overlooks in simply stating that he understood the rights in the second interrogation when he was able to read the rights out loud. I also want to touch on Judge Sabatino's question about somebody's definition about whether or not they are in fact in trouble. I think it's also critical to look as early as the initial encounter when Mr. Bullock encounters police officer Archibald in the hallway. The first thing that police officer Archibald tells Mr. Bullock is that we got a call and we got to figure this out. In Mr. Bullock's mind, everything was figured out at that point. He spoke to figures of authority. He spoke with his psychiatrist. His psychiatrist talked him down. He had a change of heart. He felt differently. He spoke with his coach in full, and the assumption from that conversation is that he wasn't kicked off the team immediately. So in his mind, figuring things out, everything was figured out at that point, and he was not in trouble. So when police officer Archibald simply says, we got to figure this out, he's under the understanding that he's going to figure things out with the police officers. Of course, the situation escalates, and Mr. Bullock recognizes this when the two other police officers come swarming towards him, as he describes, like a SWAT team. However, his concerns are constantly minimized by police officer Archibald about the indication that he could be in trouble. So by the time police officer Archibald tells him in the courtyard, when he's surrounded and that one police officer has their hand on the holster, by the time police officer Archibald tells him, you're not in trouble, what else can he do but take police officer Archibald at his word? So I do think that point is very significant in this court's analysis. Also significant is the statement that you're not in trouble was a plain lie at that point. The officers came to on campus on high alert about somebody who is accused of making a violent statement. He was certainly in trouble at that point. Officer Archibald stated several times that this complaint came from the higher ups, it came from the chief, and that this is something that he had to investigate. So clearly he was in trouble. And I also want to touch on, there was a lot of focus on these statements of not being in trouble and not under arrest. And there were also other misleading and significant statements that were made to Mr. Bullock that really undercut any value that the Miranda rights could have had. I want to point to, in particular, there's a moment in the courtyard where he's surrounded by the police officers, not only surrounded, but intentionally isolated from everybody. So he's up against the wall. He's been giving them Miranda rights, and the police officer says, "You're being upfront with us. It's helping the situation out." So misleading statements like that continue to undercut what Mr. Bullock could have understood about his Miranda rights. Similar to that is what my fellow Amici discussed in the ride from the first interrogation to the second interrogation. He's constantly told that you're not under arrest, you're not in trouble. So the officer is chuckling while he's telling this to Mr. Bullock. And what's significant is before he tells Mr. Bullock seven times that he's not under arrest, Mr. Bullock is asking, will my fingerprints be taken? Is my photo going to be taken? Because at this point, although the police officers have told him that he's not in trouble, he's sitting in the back seat of a police car, and his instincts are asking him to tell, are asking him these questions about whether or not he's in fact in trouble. And over again, it is minimized. So I think that's really significant for the court's consideration. With regard to the O'Neill issue that was discussed, with regard to the O'Neill issue that was discussed, I agree with Mr. Bullock's defense counsel in that the second interrogation was certainly a continuation of the first interrogation, and this is particularly for the reasons I listed when Mr. Bullock was in the car ride and he was told that he was not under arrest. And Detective Trito essentially tied those two together by saying that this is just a continuation of the first interaction. And the first interaction was all the information that he knew from Police Officer Archibald. And another point that I wanted to raise, which goes to the false assurances that were provided in the car that Mr. Bullock was not under arrest, I do submit to this court that those false assurances are equivalent to promises that this court has found to be so problematic. So those kinds of promises that are so enticing that would overbear somebody's will to remain silent. And so I did think that was significant to raise as well. And finally, just the general interest in this case, Centurion's experience is that people who believe that they have nothing to hide are not afraid to submit to law enforcement questioning. In this case, Mr. Bullock believed that he had nothing to hide because, as I stated before, he had spoken to all figures of authority. There was no overreaction. And so he was completely forthcoming with the police officers because he had nothing to hide and because he had no prior experience with the criminal justice system. For those reasons, I would ask this court to reaffirm the lower court's rulings.
Thank you, Ms. Francois.
Thank you.
Mr. Galdieri, brief rebuttal.
Very brief. As is often said. So there was a question about a bright line rule, the state advocating for a bright line rule. I believe Your Honor asked about that. Just to be clear, the state was advocating for the bright line rule from AGD and Vincente that was reaffirmed in Sims. But this court's decision in Sims, in this court's decision overruling the appellate division, which is that because the defendant here was not charged in a complaint warrant and no arrest warrant was issued, there was no requirement under the bright line rule to tell the defendant about his suspect status. There was also another question about, to be clear, based on the record, about why we're here when the police asked the defendant. That occurred just before they went outside into the courtyard. And then in the courtyard, there were questions, and that actually isn't, I was just looking back through the motion judge's decision, the oral decision on page 237 of the transcript, and the appellate division summary of that in its opinion. And it doesn't say expressly that occurred in the dorm room and not in the courtyard, but it kind of makes it seem that way, because they refer to the courtyard before talking about why the police were there. But if you watch the body-worn camera footage and see when that occurred, it occurred right before they went outside. And then when they were outside is when they were talking about the girlfriend's predicate info, her name, age, how long they've been dating. And then the defendant actually, without prompting, said his quote, I can't remember whether this is reflected in the transcript or you just hear it clearly on the body cam footage. This is detrimental to someone's life, he says, on his own without being asked about that. And that was then when he was advised of his Miranda rights and the argument about the implicit waiver is triggered. Diaz is wholly different than what we have here. That was a misleading statement in the context of waiver in a drug-induced death case where the law enforcement made it seem like there was a they were asking just about a drug case, not drug-induced death. One last thing is as far as the cat being out of the bag, that's really, to answer Your Honor's question about that is when the O'Neill analysis is triggered. It doesn't just mean there was a prior unwarned statement and that therefore anything that happens after that is categorically inadmissible. That's when the O'Neill analysis comes in, which is when Miranda warnings are given after custodial interrogations already produced incriminating statements. The admissibility of post-warning statements turn on whether the warnings, those that here, if O'Neill is found to be applicable, would be the warnings that were given at the police station, whether they function effectively to convey the ability to the defendant to exercise his state law right against incrimination. And as far as the factors and arguing which apply and whether it's sufficient, I would just rely on what I said initially. I know I said one last thing already, but now really one last thing. Any post-waiver assurances should not be an issue unless they're tied to an assertion of an ambiguous assertion of a right to counsel or right to remain silent, which I think is what Mr. McNamara's discussion turned on a little bit here. So I would just agree with him to the extent that he argued that.
Thank you. And thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take